Pasca is always peeking through. One of my favorite little details of this particular service is the fact that when I don my black vestments at the beginning of the service, I put on my white cuffs underneath. So if the children are observant, they might notice that the cuffs don't match the black vestments. And that's because when we do our quick change at Arise, O God, and Judge the Earth, which if we had a few more altar servers would actually include changing the altar vestments from black to white, the cuffs are the hardest part. What I learned from seminary is you put on your white cuffs so that you can quickly change all the rest of your garments. But what I love about it is that just that sense that we've gotten all week, really, all of this Holy Week, that Pascha is always peeking through. And so I wanted to focus in on three of the Old Testament stories that we've just heard to kind of bring to our attention the way that God's salvation for us, the ultimate expression of which was at Pascha in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, has always been peeking through, and usually at the worst times possible. There's a reason we tell one another stories. There's a reason we rehearse histories. Because as Christians, as followers of Jesus Christ, as the people of God, we look back on God's intervention in history over and over and over again, and we draw comfort from it. We draw encouragement from it. When things seem darkest, that's generally when our God intervenes. Tolkien famously coined a term. He said, we have a term for bad things that happen unexpectedly. We call it catastrophe. But oddly, we don't have a term for good things which happen unexpectedly. We need one. And so we coined the term eucatastrophe. You can hear, of course, the Greek prefix eu, good, that is also there in the Eucharist. So there's two major stories that are highlighted here for us. The first is Israel as they are running away from Pharaoh. It was really totally hopeless. I mean, the only chance that Israel had to get away from the Egyptians, this is the world superpower at the time. They have the latest technology, chariots. In a chariot drawn by a horse, you can outrun any man. You can outfight any man because you're protected by the chariot. Even if you have a professional army trained, the chariots are most likely going to break it. But Israel was not a professional army. They weren't trained. They were just a bunch of escaped slaves. Their one hope of getting away was the fact that God had slain the firstborn sons of the Egyptians, and Pharaoh, in a fit of pique and anger and whatever else, had finally relented and said, okay, go, get out of here. It's like, okay, if only Pharaoh will stay true to his word. If only he'll actually let us go. And they gathered all their stuff. They walked off into the wilderness following Moses and the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. And then catastrophe. Pharaoh changed his mind again. He gathered 600 hand-picked chariots, plus all the other chariots that he had on hand. And he took off after the children of Israel. As soon as Israel got wind that Pharaoh was approaching with his army, they knew they were toast. This was it. They had their backs up against this big body of water, And on the other side, there was Pharaoh and his army with of chariots. We're all going to die. And those of us who aren't going to die are going to be re-enslaved on even worse terms than before. And so they say to Moses, I love the phrase, weren't there enough graves in Egypt that you'd bring us out to die here in the desert? Moses simply says, stand still and see the salvation of your God. And the pillar of fire comes and divides the Egyptian army from the Hebrews, so that the Egyptians can't get at the Hebrews. God instructs Moses to hold his staff out over the body of water in front of them, and he sends a great east wind, which blows all night and actually blows all of the water out of the path of the Israelites. The Israelites now, ringed with this fire on the one hand, have now a way of escape on dry land through what had been a huge body of water. And so they take off. They go in and come out on the other side. And then the fire disappears. Pharaoh and his army see that the Israelites have done the impossible and have escaped. And they're back again in hot pursuit. And God tells Moses, stretch out your arm again. And the waters return to the wanted place. And God destroys the entire army of the greatest superpower that the world knew at the time. And the Israelites rejoiced. This was a eucatastrophe. Something, a deliverance totally unlooked for. God has drowned Pharaoh and his whole army in the sea. Let us sing to the Lord. Things are even worse in the next story that's highlighted for us. The story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, as they are also known by their Chaldean names. Here, Israel's already been destroyed. They no longer exist as a nation. There is no temple. There is no Jerusalem with its high and mighty walls. The great power of Babylon has already destroyed all of that. There is no part of the known world where they can run to which is not ruled by this ruthless king, Nebuchadnezzar. And then the king does the worst thing possible. He gets, in his great ego, the bright idea that he's going to create this huge statue made of gold as a symbol of his might and his power. He's going to require every single person in his empire, when the music plays, the sound of the trigon and the harp and the lyre, all of them must bow down to this golden image. There's no escape. Where do you go? So totalitarian state. They can't go back to Jerusalem and hide in its walls. Those have all been destroyed. And then the music plays. And everyone, man, woman, child, who hears the music, falls down on their faces before this huge golden image. Except for three. The three holy youths. They're standing there. Nebuchadnezzar is furious. He's going to destroy them. They have absolutely no chance. They're brought before him. as he's commanding the furnace to be stoked 7 times hotter than it's ever been stoked before, so that they can be thrown into the fiery furnace. And I love their answer when the king confronts them. You're about to be thrown into this furnace. What God is going to save you? And they say, we don't know if our God's going to save us or not. But we will not bow down to your graven image. And he throws them into the furnace. And then, against all expectation, against all reason, the flames leap out of the furnace and kill the people who are throwing the 3 holy youths into the furnace. But they themselves are unharmed. They're walking about in the midst of the flames, praising God. The final story, I was asked recently, why would that one be included? I love it, the fact that we read the entire book of Jonah. So the person who I was speaking to was like, I get some of it. You could read a little bit of it, but why the whole book? But I think it fits the pattern. The whole book fits the pattern. Because the whole book is about the goodness and the mercy of God. The problem here, and in fact, it seems the insurmountable overcoming, the problem that is insurmountable, is the problem of Jonah, God's prophet, who doesn't want to go and warn Nineveh, as God has told him that he has to. So he gets on a boat and goes the other direction. They really, really, and so this is going to make sure that God actually dooms Nineveh. If they don't hear from me, God's prophet, that they need to repent, then okay, great, they're doomed. So now what? Nineveh is doomed because Jonah is a selfish jerk. But God doesn't leave it at that. He sends this great storm. And this boat that Jonah is on is tossed about in the waves. And all of the sailors are praying to their gods. And they find Jonah asleep. And they're horrified. Why aren't you awake? Why aren't you praying to your God? Which God do you worship anyhow? You told us you were running away from him, right? And it's like, I worship the God who made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in it. And they're like, ah, that God? You managed to tick that one off? No, we're really toast. And so but so Jonah says, well, okay, there's an easy solution here. Just throw me overboard. What? No, we can't do that. It's not a good idea. So they try and throwing more stuff off the ship and rowing some more, but nothing works. Finally, they pray to Jonah's God, saying, don't hold the blood of this man. Don't hold us accountable for the blood of this man. We're just doing what he told us to do. And they throw him into the sea. And Jonah sinks down into the waves, and that should have been the end. But God wasn't finished with Jonah. And so he sends this great fish to swallow Jonah whole and spit him up so that he can go and do what he was supposed to go and do in the first place, which is go and warn the Ninevites. And so Jonah, I guess by this time, is like, okay, well, I did pray in the belly of the whale for God to deliver me, and he did deliver me, so I guess I kind of have to go do it, but I'm not going to like it. So he goes to Nineveh. And I can kind of maybe picture why, the Ninevites might have reacted now to Jonah's sermon. I mean, you can, if somebody who is speaking to you is saying, repent, or in 40 days this city will be destroyed, you can usually kind of write him off. Oh, he's one of those wackos, got the end of the world is nigh signs on him. But Jonah has just been bleached from 3 days in the belly of the whale. his whole skin would be white. He's like this ghostly figure that is coming out of the beast into the middle of the city and saying, "Repent, or in 40 days Nineveh will be destroyed." And then the unthinkable happens. The Ninevites actually listen. They actually repent. The king proclaims a decree that every man, woman, and child, every animal should wear sackcloth and fast, so that this horrible calamity that has been predicted will not fall upon them, so that they can, and God looks on them and he relents. They've repented. Now Jonah's even more angry. Problem is still with Jonah. But God is still not finished with Jonah, because he is not willing that any should perish. Jonah just wants to die. Jonah is in despair, because the one thing that he didn't want to have happen has now happened. What is God thinking? The Ninevites were horrible. They're just repenting for the sake of being preserved. They deserve to die. Why can't I just die? And so God just gives Jonah a lesson. So as Jonah is sitting there sulking, looking over the city of Nineveh in the desert, the sun beating down on him, God causes a plant to grow up overnight. And for the next day, Jonah falls in love with this plant. It's lush, it's green, it provides him with shade, and it makes his sulking and waiting so much better. And then a worm comes and eats away at the plant, and the plant withers and dies. Now Jonah is absolutely furious. God hasn't destroyed Nineveh, and God's destroyed the one thing that he loves, this plant. And finally, God speaks to Jonah. "Jonah, are you right to be angry over this death of this plant?" "Yes," he says, "I'm totally right to be angry." "Really? Well, that's funny, because this is just one little plant. Nineveh has over 120,000 people, not to mention many cattle, that I care about. You care about this plant. I care about the world." And the story is left, I think, deliberately open-ended. We never actually get to hear what Jonah's response to God is. One hopes that he finally sees the light. And I think that's kind of the point, because God was working even with Jonah, even with that one stubborn person who absolutely refuses to be comforted, doesn't want salvation, just wants to die. God is at work, even in his life, for his salvation. In all of these things, all of these stories, and not just these ones, but all of them, God is always at work, working for our salvation, working to get through to us, working to teach us that he is good, working to show us that however dark things may seem, however absolutely insurmountable the obstacles we may face may seem, he will make a way of escape. He will make a way out. God is faithful, the Apostle Paul says. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. And when you are tempted, he will make a way of escape. Because that's the sort of God we worship. That's the sort of God we have always worshipped. The God who loves us. The God who loves the whole world. and was willing to come and endure in his own incarnate flesh the ultimate catastrophe for our sake, his death. But even in that, he was at work, because death could not swallow the author of life. And God changed even that catastrophe into a eucatastrophe. This is what we are celebrating, because Pascha is always peeking through.